Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. As you know, I'm looking into some research projects that have been done around and about and for Reiki. And we're going to change the rhythm of our interviews now a little bit for this one anyway. I have the opportunity to receive a master's thesis by Tekla Eichhorn from Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. And the thesis was written in April of 2002, or well, was submitted in 2002. And it's been interesting to read it in light of the other interviews that I've just done, first with Anne Baldwin and then with Angela and Isabella, who are very precise in their science. And this, we're moving toward the other end of the spectrum, which is anthropology, cultural anthropology, I believe. And, you know, in research, when I was first a student, I realized that there were two kinds of research. There was the what we consider to be the scientific research, which has to do with control groups and measuring things precisely, and being able to measure energy has been a great question mark until the last few years. So now it's only now that we can really write up and read what would be called true scientific research on Reiki, because we now have machines to measure some of the effect of Reiki on energy and on the human body. However, you know, for all of us, I think we've all done our own research on Reiki through listening to stories, listening through stories of masters, watching people change as they move into their Reiki studentship, and so on. And that's informal research. And you can take that another step and have it be more formalized. And I think that's what Tekla did. We can ask her in a few minutes. So I'd like to bring this part of research here to the show, and to also let you know, as listeners, that you can, if you're curious about something, you can do your own informal research, that there are ways to do that, to be able to ascertain what your own opinion and ideas are in relationship to your own experience. I think that this is very important, because we're in the age of internet where people can write a lot of things about a lot of things, about, or maybe about everything, and it's their own personal opinion. But what's important for me is for you to form your own understanding of what your process is as we go through our Reiki path. So this is, as I understand it, a bit of the theme of Tekla's paper. So I'd really like to welcome Tekla to the show.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. And Tekla, I always like to start with asking people how they came to Reiki, and could you let us know how you were introduced to Reiki and what your experiences were?
Sure. Actually, you know, I was in my 20s and I was in university as an undergrad, and I had a great friend who was very interested in alternative practices of a lot of different kinds. And he was always trying to get me to go to some of these. And so it just literally, I stumbled into Reiki. I happened to have time that night and the willingness to try it out. And so I went to an open house in Regina at Marian Beakey's Reiki place, and just experienced Reiki, heard stories from people, and I felt it very relaxing, very peaceful, very welcoming. And I just really enjoyed experiencing the Reiki. And interesting thing that happened to me was that I had had a whiplash injury within the last year of that happening. And I had been in constant pain to the point where I hadn't really noticed it, and of course my friend knew about this. And towards the end of the evening, he asked me, so how's your back? And I hadn't even realized. I said, it doesn't hurt. And that was the first time since I'd had the accident about a year previous that I didn't experience any pain. So it was a really interesting thing for me because I hadn't expected really anything. I wasn't looking for anything. I wasn't, to my knowledge anyway, I didn't have any expectations. But so I ended up getting my first degree from Marion Beakey, and she's a master in Regina, and really enjoyed that and sort of didn't really do much with Reiki for quite a while. And then my academic path kind of converged with Reiki, where I had decided to do my master's thesis in anthropology, cultural anthropology, at the University of Regina, and I really didn't know what I wanted to study. I just knew that I loved this discipline and its approach, and I just sort of, in talking to my supervisor, remembered that I had had this really interesting experience, and I've always been interested in healing and medical kinds of things, but I'm also very interested in symbols and ritual and people getting together and how that connects to ideas of healing and sickness and community. And so it just sort of came together on its own. It just became something of interest to me that I decided to pursue a little further, even having had a couple years of sort of just being casual about it. I then decided to really pursue it as an interest academically, and of course that always links up personally with things that you decide to devote all your energy to in a way. So that was basically how I came to Reiki and how I brought it into anthropology for my own research.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, the title of your thesis is really provocative for me. It's Fragmented Bodies, Emerging Selves, Reiki Journeys and Practice in Southern Saskatchewan.
Yes.
So, I like that. Fragmented bodies and emerging selves. And I'm just wondering, sort of in a nutshell, what was the main, what I call it, theme of your thesis? Is
well,
that a good word to use, theme?
Yeah, theme is a good word. Well, just to the sort of nutshell answer is that I'm interested in how all of the various themes in anthropology that I study come together to sort of explore how we understand ourselves as persons in society. And so that relates in terms of how we understand our bodies, how we understand pretty much all the things around us, you know, including, like I say, bodies, healing, but some things, too, that you might not expect, and that comes into my thesis as well, such as economic exchange. Our sense of ourselves in terms of a nation was one of the things that, broadly speaking, I was interested in. So pretty much the idea in anthropology is that everything you do is connected in terms of how we understand ourselves in culture, and my particular focus was how that converges on our understanding of ourselves as persons.
Okay.
And in anthropology, we get sort of technical about what that means. In common usage, I find, or the theory is, that we sort of, when we say the term self, individual, and person, in common life or in everyday life, we really mean kind of the same thing.
Yes.
But in anthropology, we split those things and we look at them as different, different aspects of the person. So, you know, you have an individual who's a biological unit who is just separate from everyone else. And that's a term that just is sort of your starting point, okay? But when we say a person, we mean the person as an active agent in society or in culture. And when we mean self, when we talk about the self, we mean their internal understanding of their experience. An individual itself is an ideological sort of understanding of how that biological individual operates in society. society. So it's more culturally or socially specific. Okay, so that's pretty technical. I wonder, does that sound clear to you?
Yes, it sounded clear, but I lost you somewhere. So just to get this straight. So the individual is like a biological, unique, you didn't say, but do you assume unique?
Well,
a biological, unique unit?
Yeah, well, the unique is where the ideological comes in.
Okay, so forget unique. Okay,
so we just start from the basis of the only sort of, quote, common sense understanding of us is that we are these separate persons who we're born separate, we're different. Then it gets complicated, and that's where we start to create understandings of who that is and where how they relate in society. And so you have a sort of social understanding of that, and you have an internal understanding of that.
Right.
And it's all mingled into a broader cultural scope.
Uh-huh.
So the person is the agent in society. So that's the person who acts in society. And the self is more how they understand themselves emotionally, or that's that internal kind of private life.
Right.
So that's the basic distinction. And
okay. They
don't stay neat and cut and dry that way. That's
right. That's
the reason why
the good news and the bad news.
Yes. So they're, you know, just for the purpose of examining these issues, that's how we sort of divide them up. Yeah.
Okay. So you used a very interesting phrase in your thesis. It's embodied personhood.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So embodied personhood refers to the way that we understand our position in society inside the body. So how that relates to, how that combines our understandings with our practice. So what we do and how we put it into our material world. So we're always interacting with mind and emotion, this internal self and this personal self, but we are always affecting our environment with that through our understanding of our body,
uh-huh.
but also through our practice and what we do in the world.
Mm-hmm. So, when you talked about, then in the sentence you say, Reiki practitioners grapple with the problem of embodied personhood. What does that mean for you?
Yes, that really sort of became the crux of my thesis.
Uh-huh.
That they are grappling, so struggling with the understanding of how they are in society, and how that affects their practice. I think in order to make a little more sense of that, I'm going to have to get technical again and sort of explain the basic sort of theory that I'm working from.
Okay.
And that is where Louis Dumont in anthropology talked about personhood in terms of, what he did was he split personhood, comparing it to India, the Indian understanding of the self.
Right. That's East India.
Yes, East Indian.
Uh-huh.
Person of the self versus the sort of European, North American, well, he was in Europe, so European understanding of the self, of the person.
Right.
And he used the terms individual versus individual. And the individual, he argued, was the European understanding of the self that is influenced by many things, but historically and most recently capitalism.
Uh-huh.
And the idea of the individual person, see, now I'm interchanging the term self and person. I'm going to have to catch myself there. But the individual person is that unique, discrete individual, so discrete meaning separate from all others,
mm-hmm.
unique from all others, that does not experience, you know, equal to all others, so does not experience hierarchy in their life.
Right.
So we all consider ourselves to be free and equal. That's an individual. That's a corollary of individualist ideology. So that comes from that way of seeing the person as an individual.
Uh-huh. Okay? And that's from your, and that's kind of the European side of this.
That's the European side. And then Dumont argued that in contrast to that, he noticed that that East Indian people saw their lives in terms of the individual, what he called the individual. So not dividable, because, individual, if you think about the word, means not dividable person.
Right.
Right? Whereas individual means it's based on division.
Right.
So in that terms, he talked about where we see the individual as being unique. The individual was more bound into the experience of other people, other persons. Okay. There's also a hierarchical understanding of this individual, or this person. So they are not the idea of freedom. Is not the same. I don't want to say that it's not there. Equality is not the same.
Right.
Or not a consideration in Dumont's argument.
Right.
Okay, so...
So, just to get this clear, so I just want to see if I'm following you. So, for instance, this is my translation, right? So, for instance, in India, the country, there is what we call a caste. There was a caste system, and there is vestiges of that still. And in that, the caste system was also based on their religious or spiritual belief of reincarnation and so on, and karma. It was built into this whole cultural process, and so an individual. No, I mean, excuse me, I'm not being scientific here, but or anthropological. A human being, I just jump out of everything and use another word. A human being would be born, and they would see themselves in relationship to everyone else and place themselves in either a lower or a higher placement depending on where they happen to be, what parents they happen to be born to, and what those parents did and what they ended up being able to do in their life, and their definition of freedom and equality was based on this kind of relative scale of birth.
Right, and the argument would even go further to say that, and again, this is theoretically, or this is the argument, is that the ideas of freedom and equality wouldn't be a concern. Their focus is elsewhere.
Yes, for sure.
So their focus is on, the argument goes, the focus is on their connectedness to family and caste.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and so then that translates culturally, even once caste is legally abolished, it still remains, as you mentioned, in terms of the culture. So this view of the self, this view of the person is one that is connected, as you say, to caste. And so you can have interesting things like the idea that a person can be reborn as another person. So this is the idea that that person, their essence, travels across time and space.
Right.
Okay, so it's not limited to your life right now.
Right.
Okay. So that's basically the idea is of the indivisible aspect of the person in Europe versus the divisible idea of the person in India.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And those are the two examples that were taken, but this gets applied to cultures all over the world and how how people stand in relation to that scheme and, how valid it is and how it plays out. And so when I say embodied personhood, that practitioners grapple with the idea of embodied personhood, what I'm really saying, what came out in the thesis is that we have this ideology that is very powerful, that we are individuals. And the thing about cultural understandings is that we see that to be the truth. We see that to be the natural, quote, natural way it is.
Right.
But our experience all over the world, anywhere in the world, in any culture, our experience is that life is not quite like that. We are not exactly as we view ourselves in terms of individualism. The idea is that individualism plays a role too.
Right.
So we have this sense of ourselves as being equal and free and unique and like no other, but we have experiences of connectedness where perhaps we're distinguished in terms of class or gender or race, so there's divisibility right there.
Mm-hmm.
And we have connectedness to our family that we might deny it ideologically because we think we can do sort of whatever we want as an individual, that we are autonomous. But our practice is that, of course, we are connected to family, and we do have obligations and varying kinds of roles that cut into family and society and all of our practice, our relationship to the earth, our relationship to exchange, and being in community. So, so that was basically what I'm getting at when I'm talking about embodied personhood, and how we struggle with that is struggling with the idea of our person that we have versus our experience of that. Now, that to me, and I got this from people's stories, that to me was what people were experiencing when they found themselves to be, quote, sick, when perhaps medical science might not have considered them sick. And so that's where I talked about the idea of fragmentation. Because at a certain point in their journey, people feel themselves to be fragmented. And my argument was that that was because they saw themselves as individuals and had a certain expectation of how that should work. But they were experiencing this aspect of, I guess, being in community. That refers to individualism, and that to them, sort of being bombarded with this, if you will, or not fitting into it, they felt broken and somehow not whole and somehow needing fixing, whether it was physically or emotionally or whatever way that played out for them, and how they defined their illness or their brokenness.
Well, certainly, I mean, I think that this describes a lot of what was going on for me as I was in college in the 1960s, you know, where there was Vietnam, and that was a huge, well, that was one end of the spectrum. It just went against all the ideology of the time, which was about world peace and you know, getting over the two world wars and having this horrific experience as a human culture of concentration camps and so on and depersonalization, and wanting to go back, you know, and the pendulum swings then, you know, to the other side where we grew up in a really idealistic kind of environment. I feel like in North America anyway, I can say for, and I don't know if you agree with me, but it feels like that came, and then we had these experiences to deny that, and that brought out this need for me, for me in particular as a person, but also in a lot of my friends, and it felt like my generation, to find something that would bridge this, you know. And so Reiki just popped up, no matter how we found it, you know, kind of on our own level. It kind of popped up as an answer, and it's interesting for me that you use the term alternative in relationship not to medicine, particularly, although that is, you say it's an alternative healing practice, but it seems like that you're using it in more a societal or anthropological way of an alternative approach to creating a way to handle the obvious paradoxes of living in our human body.
Yes, that's...
Is that true?
That I would say that that's a very clear way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, that was really interesting to me because I'm always seeing, I first read this alternative healing practice, and then as I read further, I thought, oh, she's talking about alternative as another choice of how we can bridge this gap between our idealized version of how it should be or how we should be to what we really experience and then what society and we expect of ourselves in our society, whatever that is.
Yes, and it's interesting that you pick up on that in terms of alternative, because as an anthropologist and my focus on it, I use those terms because, and when I think of, say, medical practice, that is one choice too in terms of
health.
And it relates to this embodiment that we've been talking about of that person. So that, you know, there's definitely what we call the scientific, factual kind of experience of medicine. But all of these things are imbued with meaning. And so Western medical practice also is imbued with our sense of personhood and our own mythologies about how the world works. So, you know, that would be why, I guess, when I say alternative healing practice, for me, I'm thinking on several levels, but I'm also, which includes medical practice, but I'm thinking in a different way about medical practice.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because all of these are approaches for us to understand ourselves as persons. So
right.
Medicine, we have a view, or many of us have a view, a cultural view, that medicine is something that is imposed upon us. So, but what I would point out is that also is part of our coming to an understanding of ourselves and our persons in society and how we embody that.
Right.
So, you know, just to flesh out what you've already said, there's a lot of crossover between them, and so it's from that point of view that I saw Reiki as an alternative kind of medical practice. Because as anthropologists, when we look at medical practice, we include things like ritual practice and medical religious understandings, cosmologies, etc., and Western medicine's included in that experience and in that examination. So it is, they're all different alternatives.
Right.
So
in kind of getting to, it seemed like what you did was you did come to annual gathering at Brighton Bush, Oregon.
Yes, I did.
Which was an interesting part of your research, and we met there and had a very short conversation. And then you also, in your thesis, talk about meetings with other Reiki masters and other Reiki students and so on. And I'm just wondering, through this, what did you conclude?
Okay, when people ask me, what did I conclude, usually they mean, what does it work? Is that what you're asking me?
No, I just wondered. So it seemed like you were exploring the practice of Reiki in this context of these two ideas about how we live, whether we're an individual and that's the primary approach, or whether we're not individual, that we're like incorporated into a larger scheme of things where we are all connected, and also it's very hierarchical. So it just seemed like that in your thesis, what I gathered was that in your study of Reiki, using this template, that Reiki was a little confusing because it seemed to have a hierarchy, but it was in question, and people in the hierarchy didn't really know what they were doing, so that wasn't a clear hierarchy. And then and then people who were practitioners didn't really understand the core values, so they might given a bit of stress, like being confronted with another kind of Reiki practice across the way in a health fair, that Reiki practitioners would, instead of going toward their idealized experience of we are all one, they end up being divisional and saying, well, I'm right and you're wrong and that's how it is. So it seemed like there were a lot of contradictory kinds of experiences that you noted. And so I'm just wondering, how did this all come, you know, I don't know, I guess,
yeah, well,
where did you end up?
Right.
is my summary actually somewhat accurate?
Well, it's somewhat accurate in the sense that I did note all these contradictions. But it was never my intention to make it seem, you know, like you used the phrase "didn't know what they were doing" kind of thing. And my interest in all of this was that.
Well, maybe that's my own experience.
Yeah, you know.
Which is fine.
Well, it is. You know, that was pretty much what I experienced from people was that, and that's why the personhood issue was so important to me, was that individualism is an incredibly, it's what we call an encompassing ideology. It takes everything else into it.
Right.
And so it's such a powerful ideology that the struggles that came up, for me, that sort of was, I mean, in some ways, well, in a lot of ways, the thesis really raised more questions than it answered, and you know, sometimes that's the way it goes with the thesis.
Uh-huh.
But for me, the crux of it was this idea of the individual versus the individual. And I just found these, you know, when people were sort of having these bantering back and forth, which I see everything with a sense of humor, so that came out in my thesis a bit too, but those are interesting debates. To me, that touches, when people are in conflict, you can find the crux of what's happening in the kinds of conflicts that they're having and the kinds of contradictions that emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, I'm not poking a stick at things when I do that. I'm saying, hey, there's something interesting going on here. And for me, you know, from my perspective in the discipline and the theories I was working with, that's about how we understand ourselves as persons. And I think that, now this isn't in my thesis, but my own understanding, and totally it from a personal point of view here, is that Reiki becomes a forum for people to really work at that. And you pointed this out a little earlier when you were talking about Vietnam and those experiences from your past. It becomes a forum for that conflict to emerge and in some ways be resolved, even if it's individually personal.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But the fact that it comes together in a way where people have a sort of, if you will, a common language, a common practice to experience those differences,
uh-huh,
that's where they sort of get hammered out. So now that's me, Tekla, the Reiki practitioner, talking. That's not me, the anthropologist, at the moment.
Uh-huh.
If I can make those divisions, I don't know. But that for me was what was really interesting. And so theoretically that came out in terms of a discussion of personhood and how that comes out in terms of sort of political aspects, economic exchange, ritual practice, and how people try to construct a ritual environment to reflect their understanding of what they're doing. So I'd have to go back to personhood as being the crux of what I was trying to get at and
mm-hmm.
point out that ideology and practice come together in very interesting ways that really show us a little bit more about what's going on and get us closer to an understanding of how we live.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that there's a lot of denial in our existence, you know, in the Western world? Because most of us, I mean, I hope and I think that, well, I know actually that some of the listeners come from an Indian philosophic cultural background, and it will be very interesting to hear what they have to say after this program. So those of you who are listeners who have an opinion or wanting to share, please send in an email. Meanwhile, reverting back to my own North American, well, I would say American place, I just wonder, do you feel that this, when we talk about our personal healing journey, which you use a lot also through your thesis, that that is a euphemism for something else?
A euphemism?
Yeah, like instead of saying, this is my way of trying to resolve these very basic philosophical conflicts within me, I'm going to take a personal healing journey and try to find peace. I mean, you know, I feel like somehow there's this unspoken idea that if we are successful in our personal healing journey, that we will find personal peace.
Yes.
Do you think that's true? I mean, do you think that's an a foregone conclusion of a personal healing journey?
Not. Well, foregone conclusion is tricky, but But I do find that that's a lot of, you know, in the stories, I'm taking a lot from the stories that people told me.
Right.
And the way that they spoke about themselves and about their practice. And so in my experience, yes, that was what was happening. So, you know, there's always, in what you look at, there's always a lot that's left out. And but I had to go on what people were telling me and what I was seeing around me. And sometimes when you sort of hook in a certain way to a community, the links that you're going to make are going to be sort of related. So, you know, if there are some people who are talking about healing journey, they're going to be talking to other people who are talking about healing
right.
journey.
So right.
It's a very strong theme to the point where I viewed it as a major theme. I didn't, in my experience, I didn't see people not talking that way. And then one interesting thing that made me think about that was that a lot of people that I spoke to just went like I did to feel, to experience it, to see what it was about.
Uh-huh.
You know, they were curious. And then they would say, oh, an old injury started hurting, and you know, some sicknesses would come up from the body, and some people would talk about it as being their body releasing and starting to deal with these sicknesses, which they interpreted as having to do with their personal, their personhood and their selfhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so that very naturally flows into the concept of a healing journey. But healing can have, you know, first of all, there's a difference between healing and cure. And secondly, healing can have a lot of different dimensions to it. So we heal the mind, we heal the spirit, we heal the body, we heal communities, we heal the earth. And then there's the whole idea of cure, which is something completely different, or you know, that has some overlap but not complete. And so for me, well, for me and drawing on the experiences of people I worked with, yeah, I'd say definitely that the healing journey was an important metaphor. And I would use metaphor rather than euphemism.
Okay, I can concede that. That's fine.
just because I don't want it to come across as being a critique per
right.
se of Reiki. More pointing out what people are working with and what was fascinating to me about how they were relating to it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, it's really okay for me if it's a critique of Reiki, because that's also fascinating. I mean, my philosophy is what's interesting is what's not working.
Yeah.
You know, if I had this idea that Reiki's going to, you know, take the pain away from somebody's headache and it doesn't do it, then it piques my interest and then I'm involved. If it does it, then I consider it to fulfill my expectations, and I don't think about it very much. It's just something that happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's a good experience, but we don't learn a lot of things from good experiences. This is my conclusion as a human being, which is too bad, actually. But one of the things that I want to get to then is that if we can say that people who come into Reiki have a personal healing journey, and that seems to be somewhat successful in working out this these sort of ideological and reality conflicts, you know, that they live in. There's another part of your thesis which had to do with, now, you know, we had this idea, and this is one of our ideologies as a Reiki community, that we can change the world, to put it bluntly. And it seemed that in your thesis, and I just read the sentence, the ethnography of Reiki practice shows that Reiki practitioners do not radically change society as they claim to.
The key word there is radical. Because
okay, just checking.
No, because my argument throughout the thesis is that we have this encompassing ideology of individualism, and I did encounter people who talked as if they were doing something completely and utterly different.
Right.
And that wasn't everybody, but it was a theme enough that I wanted to question it and ask questions about it. And so, you know, we don't transcend individualism entirely, nor do we embrace it completely. We don't transcend capitalism as some would like to do. You know, there are all sorts of themes that they talked about where they were trying to be completely other than.
Right.
And I understand that not everybody in Reiki is trying to do that. But the key word there is radical. And for me, that actually makes the practice more sustainable and more powerful in what it does. Because it means that it's working with real issues and real things that are going on in people's lives. And so the change is subtle. And, in a lot of cases, it can be less than, I can't find the word, but less than subtle, more obvious. But my own belief and my observation is that change is a lot more slow moving, and that kind of change is a lot more powerful than a sort of magical
right
change that I found some people were, at least in some point of their journey, were looking for.
Right.
And that part of that grappling that I talked about earlier was about coming to terms with that it wasn't going to do what they thought it might do, but it did something else that was also purposeful.
Yeah. Well, listeners, I hope you can follow this, because for me it's interesting, but I hope it's interesting for you too, obviously. So further on in the same paragraph, which I find really fascinating, it made me, you know, like reading this made me really stop and think about my own experiences. And, you know, I was once described by my mother, who is, of course, the ultimate resource for me, accurate or not, that I'm more idealistic. And I also am much more into what I can see as the potential of any situation. And that somebody else, a dear friend of mine, was described by my mother as somebody who was a realist, who could see what was going on in the moment and respond to what was really happening rather than potential, which I thought was an interesting observation. I wasn't very happy about it, but okay. This is what catches me. Later on in the paragraph, you say that their ritual practice, Reiki practice is effective to the limited extent that it provides a means of incorporating a sense of community into an individualist ideology that they regard as socially atomistic. What's socially atomistic?
Socially atomistic is this idea that we are this unique person. It relates to individualist ideology.
Uh-huh, right.
Now, for everyone listening, too, we all have to remember this was a thesis and not a book that was published for
right.
everyone to read, so it's written for other anthropologists to read.
Right.
So socially atomistic relates to individualist ideology, and if you can imagine the idea of an atom, which our idea of it is that it's this little particle that kind of spins around on its own axis or whatever, spins around its own orbit, it's separate and distinct from all else.
Okay, now just a second. Can I interrupt you a little bit?
Sure.
So then you go on to say, for individual practitioners in their daily life, this is important. For Reiki practice as a whole, it is problematic. So I totally agree with you.
Good.
Yeah, and it's not supposed to be like that. Like this is my this is my idealistic self, or it's supposed to be beneficial to everybody and create peace. I mean, this was our thing, and it's still our thing. I mean, we look at something like a global response to the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, I guess it's called. But anyway, in the oil spill off the coast of the United States. And, we all point a finger at the oil company. But in truth, that was a bubble that burst. It was like the physical manifestation of a socially created norm for me.
Yes.
Of needing to have a car, needing to have plastic, needing to have all the things that petroleum products give us in our lives, and not being willing to give them up so that the oil companies don't drill in places that are that can compromise the health of the whole environment that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
So, I feel that this is exactly it, to put this out into what I would call real life situations. This is this whole interesting thing that it builds our strength as individuals, also propels us to community, and when we get there, we don't know what to do with community.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I call it problematic, because, everybody has their own individual idea of what that community should be doing.
Exactly, right? It sort of works in some ways. We move forward as a whole, or along as a whole, all the while kind of arguing about what the whole is.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So as an anthropologist, do you find this to be historically repetitive? Like, do you think that this just happens in human...
Yes, absolutely.
In our human society?
Yes, yeah. And what becomes interesting is the sort of ways that we come together to embody that constant conflict. And so, I think that coming together in something like Reiki practice is moving in that direction towards a peaceful direction. When people come together in that way, that's a great embodiment of that struggle, I think, and very productive in a good way, even if we're sometimes not feeling all that productive or peaceful about it.
Right. Or hopeful. I think hopeful is really, people are talking about, in the United States anyway, President Obama, his key word was hope. I think that is diminished quite a bit, which is too bad, actually. I think that what people don't realize, in my experience of actually going through my own very critical processes in my Reiki practice, that what follows after hope is descending. And then, if we can maintain the attitude of hope, we come up the other side.
Yes.
And we're into the descent, but people are saying that hope has been a failure. And for me, in applying what I've learned in Reiki, it gives me the sustainability to remain hopeful as we go through the cycle of descending into what we might call the depths and then coming back up again.
Yes, I agree with you there. Because that moment of hope, you know, for example, when Obama was elected, you know, we were excited in Canada. It was hopeful. That's a time when people, Victor Turner called it communitas. Okay, it's a time when people sort of imagine their differences to have dissolved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when that's in reality not what really happens, but we have this moment where we have hope, where we believe that that can be possible. And the fact that it goes back to, quote, reality, where we have these differences and hierarchies and different focuses, doesn't eliminate the fact that we can move in that direction. You know, whoever thought that we'd have, the Earth, would have a President Obama?
Uh-huh.
Who would have thought that, you know, in your generation?
Right. I agree.
So, you know, the movement has already been in that direction. And you're right, you just have to keep your eye on the ball. And the United States has been experiencing hard times right now, and so it may seem like the whole world looks that way. It's not exactly. You know, we're not feeling that way quite in Canada, you know, and those things rebound as well.
Right.
So, now I'm going on a completely different tangent, but it all relates to how I put this into my thesis as well, is that I do definitely see a movement and a value in doing these things, and that the conflict, as you say, is what makes it interesting, and we do learn from that and work from that.
Yeah, but do you think, as an anthropologist, that in our life, what we see as conflict is actually motivation?
I'm going to be slippery and say I'm not sure what the difference is.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Well, it's just that a lot of people see conflict as what they would call negative. And
yes.
Personally, and especially through my Reiki practice, I see conflict as something that draws my interest to a certain point and allows me to actually put my attention to a point that creates what I would call healing.
Yes. Yeah, and especially if sometimes you can substitute the word healing to resolution.
Resolution, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's a drag, but we're almost out of time. I would just like to read the last few lines of your thesis, and I hope that people have gotten kind of an indication of what you wrote, because I find it fascinating. It's really aroused a lot of, you know, thinking in me. Just even imagining to take a different viewpoint from scientific experiments to around to see, listen to stories and to apply it to anthropology, which is like, for me, a way to see our society as a whole, all what has been and maybe what will be in the future, and our patterning throughout that. And it's a great overview for me. And what you have written, or what was in your thesis at the very end was, a Reiki practitioner of 15 years attempted to encapsulate her view of Reiki's purpose. She said, in the past 15 years, Reiki has been the vehicle that has brought life's purpose into reality. It's been such a large journey, and it just continues to deepen. In my sense of who we are as human beings, and that there is a unity, between us. Reiki is a practical, real bridge that lets us know that experience of unity. And then you say, the propensity of Reiki practitioners to assert a transcendent position within broader social contexts is perhaps itself a product of encompassing individual ideology. I find that to be a really interesting sentence. It's like, as we get stronger and in realizing our individual ideas of who we are, that allows us to transcend the differences and see society or the context of our oneness as not a conflict, but as a natural way of being, I would say. Is that true? Is that accurate? I would say more.
My only answer is, again, is going to sound kind of slippery, because what you just said is very ideological.
Right. No, I'm just trying to find out what this sentence means.
Okay. So, it's kind of what I'm trying to say there, and in some way I'm writing for my supervisors when I say that, who read my thesis.
And, yeah, that's okay.
You know, and so throughout the whole journey of writing that thesis, I had to kind of stay away from my own personal,
right,
or try to keep a distance from that.
Right.
So, and again, earlier in our conversation, I had said usually when people ask me what my findings were, they mean, does it work? And so that's my effort to kind of say there's something here. And, you know, so although I started talking in the idiom of transcendence and radical change, the fact that that isn't what I see to be happening simply doesn't mean that it's not a valuable practice and that there isn't meaning and truth in it,
mm-hmm,
and efficacy, you know, that it actually does something. So it's a very, it's a way, and also to be honest with you, as I was writing it, I felt conflicted in how I was talking about Reiki practitioners, and I didn't want them to think that I was sort of poking a stick at them. And in a way, it's a kind of effort for me to say to the Reiki community and to you, because I knew I would be giving you this thesis, to say just that whatever criticisms are embedded in this thesis are not about what I find for the practice. Okay. The thesis had to be limited in certain ways, so I decided to look on personhood rather than on broader sort of political and social issues. So, basically in that, I'm saying to everybody, this is a valuable practice, and yes, we can move in those directions, and there is hope. And I'm a scientist.
Right. Well, that's good. That's good.
You know, because that was that, and this is an interesting thing too, is that there were moments where that was questioned because of the nature of what I was studying.
Right.
And so usually I found, and it'd be interesting to see what others found that you're talking to, I found that people really wanted to know was I real? Was I doing this? I got asked outright whether I was, quote, a true believer, meaning, are you doing this to promote Reiki, or are you doing this to truly learn about Reiki? And so that's a whole other conversation.
It is a whole other conversation. But I don't want you to, I just wanted to interrupt you, but I didn't.
Yeah.
In thinking that you might have to be defensive, because you don't. I mean, just let me finish. Mainly because we don't have much time, and I get to talk. and mainly because, you know, I think that all of us, in our own little world, like, we can see that Reiki makes a difference in our lives, in our personal life from the inside out. You know, how I view life is different, and that's a great change. But how I view life has changed, and so does it actually change the people around me? Well, I don't know. It could be just because I have a different viewpoint now on the people around me. It might not be changing them at all. It just may be my own personal, you know, perspective. And then, you know, we would like to say that we promote world peace and so on, but you know, as real life practitioners, you know, we can't even get it together to get a good recycling program together with a group of local Reiki people. How are we going to affect the world thought process, you know, and are we really going to, when people decide to send Reiki to the president or to, you know, Idi Amin or somebody else out there that they don't know, to, you know, promote their idea of world peace, is that really effective? And where is the effectivity? And I think that that's a really great question that you raised.
Yeah. And, you know, in my lifetime of 43 years, I've seen a Cold War. I've seen the wall come down. I've seen a black president, an African-American president elected to the United States. You know, my personal answer is yes, yes, and yes. You know, the recycling program, who talked about that 20 years ago?
Right.
You know, so the maybe agendas of different people on that scope are different, but I'm excited to hear that you're talking about Reiki and recycling. You know, that's movement in itself. So I'm seeing directions. You know, my kids now are going to school. I'm seeing enormous differences in how that community operates.
Mm-hmm.
These are all changes that I believe, you know, I can't, you know, it's not, it's a turning, a slow turning, I believe, for people in a society where there are ones who become interested in something like Reiki, and that all adds to a bigger movement in that direction. So, I feel great hope when I see those kinds of things happening, even if people struggle all the way. That's okay with me.
Great. Well, that's wonderful. And thank you very much for, you know, being willing to come on the show and talk to us and sort of, you know, put a different perspective on our Reiki practice and how it can be seen from the outside, but also how we can answer some of our own questions from within.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, listeners, we're a little bit over time, and I just want to say thank you for hanging in there, and it was a great conversation, and I thank Tekla for coming on the show, and this is the show for today, and we'll be with you next week. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.